Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Let's take a look at what's going on in the world of wildlife. You ready for that? I am. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest today. He comes by most months on the first Wednesday of the month to talk with us about what's going on out there. And as always, there's, I'm sure, plenty going on and plenty for you to hear about and probably a few things for you to call in and talk with us about or email us about or maybe Facebook is about. You can call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or you can go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. And I hope you do that. Scott, welcome back.
Well, it's good to be here, Larry. The nice thing is the animals are always out there, whether it's the first of July or the 1st of December, they're there. It's just a matter of what they're up to. So
Things a little different this year. Last year was so dry. This year we got all that flooding, and how's that affecting the wildlife?
Just incredible. To think back just a year ago, we couldn't buy a drop of rain. Right. It was just desperately dry, and we were talking about the impacts of drought. Now, a year later, we had nearly 11 inches of rain or something like that in June. We're almost at our seasonal normal already, and it's only – I hope this means it's not going to rain the rest of the year. But nevertheless, there have certainly been some impacts. I was up at the cabin last week, and holy moly, the mosquitoes are ferocious in the North Woods. Not so much down here, and I think Phil's explanation has been well-publicized around here. There's just been so much rain that the mosquitoes have been overwhelmed to the point that their reproductive efforts kind of been flushed out by the persistent rains, and that's really slowed things down. And in thinking about impacts on other things, we often think of a wet year as being terrific for amphibians. And holy cow, the frogs and salamanders must be having a great year, but I have a feeling that there was some of that flushing effect as well, where frogs have been in ditches and shallow ponds and whatnot, and as they got flooded out, some of their reproductive effort must have been lost as well. But overall, I think it should be good for things that like the water. For other things, some of our ground nesting birds, you know, for the grouse and the pheasants and the turkeys and things like that that may have picked a low spot to nest, or the simple surface flooding took out nests or affected the chicks after they hatched. And we'll talk about the impact on grouse numbers a little later with another question. But there could have been some negative effects there. But overall, boy, look, the landscape, it looks tropical out there. Everything's so green and there's vegetation everywhere. They're pretty good for those things looking for green stuff to eat like the deer and whatnot. Things are good.
And yet, with all that supposed feed out there, my bird feeders are, I'm telling you, inundated. It's like, I can't believe it.
Well,
in fact, it's getting kind of expensive, to be perfectly honest.
It is. I mean, last year we talked a lot about the price of sunflower seeds, and they haven't come down a whole lot. And the speculation a year ago was that they would not. So when you start factoring in the costs, and then you start to think, well, gee whiz, do the birds really need those seeds in the summer with all that stuff out there? Sure, it's easier for them and convenient and so on, but do they really need it? And then that leads one to consider, as my wife was doing last night when she looked at all of our feeders, and they were covered with birds, and said, holy mackerel, you got to fill the feeders every day. Should we be doing that? And I guess this becomes something of a toss-up for bird feeding enthusiasts. On the one hand, we really enjoy seeing the birds year-round, and with the windows open and you're looking outside more, I think we get probably more enjoyment out of seeing the birds, and especially the birds coming in with their family units to the feeders in the summer, than perhaps we do in the winter when everything's closed up. So we've got a family of rose-breasted grosbeaks, for example, that are regular visitors, and the male's just a beautiful bird, and lots of others as well. So it's great as far as the bird attention is concerned, but it's absolutely imperative that anyone feeding actively this time of year has got to do a pretty good job of keeping those feeders clean. With all this moisture, I looked at a couple of my shelf feeders the other day and said, holy mackerel, they're just caked with old seed hulls and assorted other things, and I need to take those down, scrape them out with a putty knife, get them clean, wash them up, dip them in a weak bleach solution, and then dry them, put them back up. Otherwise, you put all these birds that you're enjoying at some risk because there are a whole host of diseases that are greatly facilitated by warm, moist weather, and that's one of the reasons why some people choose not to feed in the summer, besides the expense and the fact that the birds could probably fend for themselves. But the flip side is, it's still fun.
I've got all these cardinals coming to our feed, and I love seeing those cardinals. I have these tube feeders that are designed so that if a squirrel steps on it, it drops down and kind of closes off the feed. Well, I had to completely take those apart, really, mm-hmm. and clean them out because they just got all caked up. And really, it was a little bit of work to do that.
Well, it is a little bit of work, but you really have to do it, or you put the birds that you're enjoying at some risk. So it's essential.
Lee and Spooner has a question. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, hi. Twice in the last few years, we've found loon babies on the road about 600 feet away from the lake. And my first question is that as dangerous as it appears for them? The loon that I found yesterday was so small, he didn't even have any feathers yet. He just had down. And then I wanted to ask if I did the right thing when I took care of him.
What do you mean by, maybe I don't want to know this, but what do you mean by taking care of him?
Well, he was out on the blacktop road, and I figured he was going to die if he stayed there. So what I did is I took my shirt off and put it on the ground, and then I wiggled my finger at him, and he came running over to peck at it. And I flipped the shirt over on him on both sides and picked him up in a sort of a bag and took him down to the edge of the lake and let him hop back in.
Well, okay, first of all, we've got a fundamental problem here. I don't mean to question the identification, but I just can't imagine how a loon chick would get away from the water or up on a road. I mean, even the adults are incapable of that. Their legs...
Twice.
But their legs are so far placed back on their body that they're notorious for never getting more than a couple feet from the water. And the chicks, they nest on the water. So physically, I just don't believe that there's any way for a loon chick to find itself in that position. Now, there are lots of other things that could be up on the road that could run, as you said. Now, a loon chick...
Okay, let me tell you what it was, what it looked like, and then you can tell me what it was, maybe.
Well, let's give it a shot.
Okay, it was about the size of two fists. If you put one fist on top of the other, he was about that size.
Okay.
He was dark gray down, and he had a long, sharp beak.
Okay.
He had webbed feet, and when I took him down to the lake, he hopped into the lake, and then he submerged himself twice before he went away. And he didn't go like a duck. He kind of went like a submarine, you know. He just kind of glided under. And this is the second time we've seen this. And this little guy was quite agile. I mean, he's not agile like a duck was or a goose, but he could scoot along the road 6-8 feet at a time.
Well, that's a pretty interesting one, Lee.
If you ever see this again, you better be taking a photo of it.
We need a picture, but let's try and sort this out here. There are initially, when you described a long, sharp beak and a bird that was pretty agile, I thought, well, gee, there are all sorts of herons and whatnot that would be nesting away from the water in large trees, and I could see a young one being pretty agile. But they would not have swum away and certainly not dived in the water.
No.
So the options are pretty limited. I was thinking, gee, a merganser offspring, for example, would swim like that and would have a long beak. But the two fist size is pretty big for a young merganser.
That's a possibility, though.
And the other one, cormorant is a possibility.
Oh.
Young cormorants are dark gray and kind of ungainly looking, but they're more mobile
agile
than a loon would be, and they would dive the way you described it.
That's
another possibility, but you know, beyond that, Lee, we're forced into some speculation here without a picture, and if any of our tens of thousands of skilled birders out there have another suggestion as to a bird that would dive and swim away like that, I just don't think we're dealing with a loon, though, Lee. I just think it's physically impossible for a loon to get into that situation, good.
I think you should go online and type in baby cormorant or pick photo of baby cormorant or photo of young cormorant and see, because cormorant sounds like really a good possibility.
You know, there aren't that many other birds that would dive, Larry.
No.
The grebes, the loons, the cormorant. What are we missing? I can't think of much. The mergansers, but not that big. Well, okay, we'll
Thanks,
see.
Lee. Thanks for calling. Lori in Sparta, it's your turn. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thank you for taking this call. My neighbor has a problem. Something is climbing her tree and stripping off, it's maple trees in her front yard, stripping off
the bark.
Bark in like long strips.
Yep.
Okay. Somebody told her it might be a porcupine, but we've never seen any around.
Well, it could be a porcupine, but I think it's far more likely. Is this kind of in town, in the country?
No, we're kind of in the country.
Well, either way, the likely bark strippers, especially on a maple, are gray squirrels.
No kidding.
Yeah, they can. We've had over the years run into the problem many times.
Oh.
It often involves maples, but it may also involve basswood, a few other trees with kind of thin, not very plate-like bark. And I had some pictures from the Eau Claire area a few years ago with big, big maples, and they were stripped completely clean.
Oh.
I mean, they were white.
Yeah, so, now she sprayed, you know, there's stuff you can spray on when you cut a limb off.
Yep.
I don't know how good it is or anything, but she got some of that and had someone go on a ladder up and spray because she's afraid she might lose these. What can she do?
How big are the trees?
How big would you say those trees are?
Not in height, in terms of diameter of the
trunk.
Diameter?
I honestly don't know.
So, I mean, big round as your arm, big round as your leg?
More than that. I think they're probably, they might even be dinner plates.
Okay.
Size, but I'm not sure.
Are they isolated, or is the canopy of the tree all intertwined with other trees?
I think they're two, and they're somewhat isolated. I wish I could see your front yard from where I am.
Okay, so if the trees are isolated, you have a chance. If the trees are in touch, basically, with other trees, the squirrels can move in the canopy. If the squirrels can't move from tree to tree, then you need to put a squirrel guard on the trunk of the tree. The spraying, especially up in the smaller limbs, really isn't going to do anything
frankly,
for the amount of effort.
Harm.
For the amount of effort, it's not worth it. But you can do one of several things. You can either wrap the trunk of the tree with sheet metal or something smooth like that up 4 or 5 feet from the ground so the squirrels can't get past that sheet metal. It's too slippery and can't jump past it. Or you can use the same material, either sheet metal or plastic, and essentially make an inverted cone around the tree the way you'd use a cone to protect a bird feeder pole so that the squirrels can't get around the cone. But one way or the other, you have to keep the squirrels out of the tree.
And we're no longer recommending tree wound dressing on any trees other than oaks that may have been damaged in the wintertime or in the summertime because, frankly, you can get infection going underneath that dressing. So not something that's recommended anymore.
If you can't protect the tree with a cone or a cylinder of some material that the squirrel can't get past, then the only other alternative is to try and deploy a couple of live traps or something near the base of the tree or even on a platform in the tree to try and target the squirrel that's figured out that that's a good thing to be doing. And what they're doing is stripping the bark off, and then they use the cambium in the inner bark as a food source.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist. He's been with us for many a year. Comes by typically on the first Wednesday of most every month. That won't happen next month, but normally. We have Facebook comments and photos, Scott, and there's a Facebook photo from Kimberly, who's from the Madison area, of a turtle that she saw on the shore of Lake Mendota. Looks like a pretty large turtle. What do you think it is?
Well, it could be very large. We found some huge specimens of this turtle in the Madison Lakes. It's a soft-shelled turtle. Some people call them leatherbacks or pancake turtles. They're really flat. The shell is really pliable, hence the name soft-shelled turtle. And they've got a long nose with kind of a beak-like appendage. Yeah. The only time they come out of the water, for the most part, is to lay eggs, which is probably what this one was trying to do. And they can get pretty big. Biggest one I've ever seen was in Lake Monona, and it had died, and someone found it on the shoreline. It had crawled through the waistband of what looked like a man's bathing suit or a pair of boxer shorts or whatever, went in through the big waistband, and then tried to crawl out a leg, which was smaller. So it got tangled up, and it eventually must have drowned or starved or whatever, and someone found it dead. And it was huge. It was the size of a bushel basket. But in any event, it's a soft shell, and I can't tell from the picture even getting up close to it, but in the lake it's probably a spiny soft shell as opposed to a smooth soft shell. Those are the two species we have. So that's what it is.
There we go. And Arlen in Gillett is up next. Let's go there. Hi, Arlen.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question about deer, mule deer in particular. I've read a couple of accounts where over the years, once or twice, a mule deer has actually been registered in Wisconsin during deer season. I just want to know what you know about that, if those accounts are bogus, anything at all that you know about the mule deer as related to Wisconsin or nearby.
I have never heard that.
I've heard the rumors a couple of times, but as far as I know, there have been no validated or bona fide cases of mule deer. I don't doubt that maybe a mule deer was registered, but I doubt that it was actually killed in Wisconsin. Lots of Wisconsinites head west, Colorado, Montana, Wyoming, etc., to hunt mule deer, and I can see where one might have somehow found its way back in here, the way other odd stuff finds its way back. But as far as I know, we're still quite a ways east of any potential mule deer range. I don't know of any valid records of a mule deer occurring in the state, period.
You don't know of anything in Minnesota or Iowa as a population of any kind?
You know, I think it's possible as you get out in the western parts of either state, that's a possibility, but we're just too far east.
Yeah.
It's not even listed on the hypothetical species list for Wisconsin for mammals.
Okay, that's pretty much what I assumed. Well, thanks. That's helpful.
Yep, thanks, Arlen, for calling. And Gary in the town of Ween, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Gary, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and Scott. Love your show.
Thanks.
I'd called about a year ago to talk to Scott. I just thought of that when you were talking about big turtles, about this huge snapping turtle. I wondered how old it was. Well, I got to see it again twice this spring. Looks like it made it through the winter. It's bigger than ever. But my question is on crayfish. And I caught a trout the other day. It had 6 crayfish in it, 2 in its mouth when I caught it, and then 4 in the digestive tract. And I was wondering what the lifespan is of a crayfish, and I know very little about them.
Well, let's see. Where should we start on that, Larry? I mean, crayfish, native crayfish are quite common in most Wisconsin waters,
right,
and they're a very popular fish food. For smaller species, obviously for trout, they're notorious or have been for a long time as a bass bait, and there are lots of artificial rubber and plastic plugs and synthetic baits that imitate a crayfish in the water. So the crayfish relationship to fishing and fish is well known. The problem, of course, in fairly recent years has been the onset of the arrival of the rusty crayfish, which is another species not native here and very destructive of native vegetation and whatnot. It has a brown spot on the side, which on the carapace, which helps identify it. And because of the appearance and spread and potential spread and damage from the rusty crayfish, then that's greatly curtailed the ability to use, sell, move, and so forth crayfish, much the same as we have minnow regulations now because of VHS and disease problems. So, yes, there are lots of native crayfish out there. Some of them actually build little chimneys on on land but close to the water table. They're in the water. They're, my suggestion is that in terms of learning something about them, you know, Google them or check out a natural history book, and there'll be plenty of stuff. But they're quite common.
Thanks, Gary, for calling. John in New Berlin, hello.
Hello. Good afternoon. I had kind of a simple question about ants. I've had a parcel in New Berlin for the last 20 years, and I'm seeing a spike in the ant mounds in my backyard, especially this year. Usually I have maybe 5 or 6 in a 5-acre parcel that I could see, and then now I'm getting, I see 30 of them. And in red, black, carpenter ants, you know, that's what I'm seeing. I'm just wondering, trying to understand if it's drought or is it just their life cycle that's spiking them or what?
It's a little out of our turf. Phil Pelletieri could help out with this a lot, but I'd have to say that I've seen a lot of pretty big mounds around my trails around the prairie and in some of the places where I hunt and wander around the woods. Whether this is just a general spike in ant populations, but I'm guessing that because of all the water and the high water table, that they're a little more conspicuous this year than they might be or have been in a drier year. And that's about all I can tell you about it. But I just happen to have a copy of a professional magazine here called The Wildlife Professional, and one of the articles I was reading that, and Larry and I talked about this a little earlier, it's a really neat article entitled Ants For and As Wildlife, and the subtitle is Reconsidering the Little Things That Run the World. And it's a fascinating account of the different species of ants that have become commonplace or are commonplace in ecosystems here and around the world, and how vitally important they are and how we should probably be paying more attention to them. So if you can find online a copy of the Summer Wildlife Professional, I think you'd find that article pretty interesting. But in the meantime, we'll defer to Phil to answer the question about whether floods have just made them more visible or whether there are really more of them.
Yep, thanks, John. And that Wildlife Professional magazine, actually, this issue is quite a few Wisconsin stories in there.
There's some really neat stuff in here that's relevant to Wisconsin. First of all, there's a very nice article by Jonathan Pauley, one of my colleagues in the Forest and Wildlife Department, on the situation with American martens in Wisconsin. And that's come up on the program before. It's entitled, Can a Struggling Native Survive? And it talks about the three pulses of releases of American martens in the Shawamigan, Nicolet, in northern Wisconsin to try and get that animal reestablished after it was extirpated many years ago. And they're having a tough go of it for a variety of reasons. There are lots of things credited, I guess, with being threats to the marten population, including predation, which may even involve a related mustelid or member of the weasel family, that being the fisher. Changes in habitat that are unsuitable, climate change, of course. For some reason, they're reproducing very poorly. And there have been some problems with incidental trapping and roadkill. So that's a neat one. There's a really nice article to help people understand EHD, epizootic hemorrhagic disease, which was reported in Wisconsin last year, but is generally a problem to the south and east and west of us. But it has it can be a major threat to the deer population in some areas. So that's coming along. There are a couple of other things like the ant article and just some general things that were pretty interesting, too. So it was a good issue.
Very good issue. Tom in Three Rivers, we'll go to you. Then we've got so many Facebook and email questions. I want to get some of those, too. But let's go to Tom in Three Rivers. Hi, Tom.
Hi. It's actually Three Lakes.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, lakes, rivers, such a...
three lakes, okay. All right.
We're in northern Wisconsin, up near Rhinelander and Eagle River.
Yep.
Fairly dense forest, probably about 30 or 40 years old, with a lot of dense undercover. And last night at, it was about 12 o'clock midnight, we heard a real strange animal sound. And I was wondering, Scott, if you might be able to identify it. I was able to record it. I was about 200 feet away, I think. But I was wondering if I could play that recording and see if you could identify it.
Well, there are a lot more people listening besides Larry and I, so I'm sure we're going to get an answer from someone. Fire away.
All right, here we go. You picked that up all right?
Yes, I think so, but picking it up isn't helping me much with identification.
How about a young owl?
Well, did it sound like it was coming from the ground or up in the trees, or couldn't tell?
It sounded like it was closer to the ground. In fact, at first, I thought it was something that got its leg caught in something, like a leg hole trap. But then after it did this for probably 15 minutes, it moved all the way around to the other side of our house, probably a distance of about 400 feet, continuing to make the noise as it moved. And we could hear some crushing of brush and that sort of thing as it moved. But perplexed as to what that sound might be.
Well, that makes three of us now.
Yeah.
And probably a lot of listeners, too. But maybe somebody's got some idea or has heard it before. It seemed pretty high-pitched. It was obviously very loud and persistent. And all I can say is that either in the case of a young animal, like the owls Larry mentioned, like barred owls, for example, are notorious. They can make all kinds of bizarre sounds. You'd think someone was being literally dismembered in the woods and turns out to be an owl, mm-hmm. owlet, or an animal, as you suggested, that was in some sort of distress, injured or otherwise. But what it was specifically, I'm pretty curious now, too.
Okay. Can you play it again, or do you have it? Do you play it even a little louder?
I really can't get it much louder, but I will play it one more time.
Play it one more time.
Let's see who calls in on this one.
I have no idea. You know, a fawn wouldn't make that, would it?
I don't think so. That's pretty. That's got a lot of carrying power too.
Yeah, that's got a lot of. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
we've had fawns in the area. We've heard raccoons fighting. We know what they sound like. But we've never heard anything like this before.
Well,
definitely a panic mode. As I approached it with a flashlight. Just seeing if I could get a little closer to see what it was, and it got more agitated as I got closer, and then the crashing of the brush made me think, gee, what if it's a bear cub? I didn't want to be out there in my shorts and sneakers after something that might do some harm, so I backed away.
Well, let's see.
Stay listening, Tom.
Stay listening. Let's see who calls in. That's a good one.
Yeah, that's a real good one. We'll see. I bet you we get some calls or some emails on it. We had several questions online here. Barb wonders, are the orioles nesting and not coming to feeders as much as they do in May and June? I think that's probably
true.
Well,
that's certainly a yes, and I have to say that my oriole season with my jelly feeder was very shortened this year.
Yeah.
The orioles showed up, but what was your experience, Larry?
Nothing.
Nothing at all.
Nothing at all for the first time in years.
I mean, I used to go through 3 or 4 2-pound jars of jelly. We didn't even go through half a jar, and I only saw at most a male and a female at a time, and there used to be a half a dozen of them competing. So I'm not sure what happened with the orioles, whether the damp and late spring and all the rain moved them out of the way or caused them to nest earlier or ignore the grape jelly, but our experience is about the same. And now at this point, even if it had been a good year in May and early June, they'd be off nesting now anyway.
Yeah. How many broods do robins have each summer, and do they stay in the same nest all summer or move and make new ones? Somebody wondered.
Well, it depends a little bit on the fate of early broods. They can have several broods. Especially if they lost one or the fledglings early on. And generally, I don't think they'll use the same nest for a second brood. So not a particularly definitive answer, but yes, they will have multiple broods. But usually by this time, they're fledging. I've got two nests under the deck. The young are about ready to go, and I've seen some fledglings hopping around. The robin nesting season should dry up pretty quickly, which is a good thing, even if it's second broods, because their nesting behavior is, of course, related to that annoying spring problem of the males attacking windows.
Yeah.
And that all winds down by this time of year.
Someone bought a cardinal nesting house, wondering where in the yard it should place, on a tree branch or on a post or...
Well, I can't answer that because I've never seen a cardinal nesting house or heard of one. Because
I've never either.
Cardinals are not a bird that uses an artificial nesting structure, so I don't know what it would look like, and therefore can't tell you where to place it. But I wonder where it came from and how it was advertised.
Debbie emailed us from Janesville, near Janesville, and in the past summers have had many hummingbirds to the feeders. This year, not nearly as many, wondering if this cold spring had an impact.
Same answer. We made up a new batch of sugar water this morning, and again, my wife commented and said, "Say, have you seen a hummingbird yet?" I said, "Well, I've seen a couple visiting the flowers in the window boxes and buzzing around, but in terms of having them actively at the feeder or squabbling with each other over feeder rights, nothing, just like the orioles." So the general sense when people make an observation like this is to attribute it to some sort of disaster that happened on the wintering grounds, migration or whatnot. I think in probably the Orioles case, hummingbirds case, and a whole lot of other observations, that most of this is related to the bizarre weather that we've had and all the water.
Jack emailed us. His brother-in-law, who lives in Virginia, has an in-ground pool that's been used, hasn't been used for a few years, wants to get it in working condition, but it's filled with leaves and breeding bullfrogs. What is the best way to get rid of the frogs and tadpoles without hurting them? He says, brother-in-law is not the most patient person, so it has to be an efficient and easy way to do it.
Well, okay, couple suggestions. I'm not sure it's probably a good-sized pool.
Yeah.
The frogs themselves, the adult frogs, could be netted and removed to a nearby pond, stream, or whatever else. That's the only hope there. The tadpoles, usually at our latitude, it takes 2 years for a bullfrog tadpole to metamorphose into a bullfrog. So there may be some left from last year that would turn into frogs this year. This year's hatch, and it's pretty early for bullfrogs, are late singers, the latest singing frog we have.
Well, it's out in Virginia.
Yeah. I don't know enough about the chronology there, but if there are tadpoles present, they could be this year's new tadpoles. They could be big ones left from last year. Either way, the only thing they can do to help is to get somebody in the pond with a seine, and just as if they were seining minnows, seine out those tadpoles, put them in a bucket, take them to the nearby pond, and they're probably not going to get them all, but mortality in a situation like that is natural, normal, and expected. So save as many as you can, move them, then clean out the pond and go about with the restoration.
Facebook question from Roly: is there a connection with wildlife and the ancient geology of Wisconsin? Our state's partitioned by glaciation. For example, I've read that glaciers eliminated earthworms. Would the driftless areas have different species? Kind of a big question.
Certainly, depending on how far you want to go back to ancient geology, as the questioner posed, shaped Wisconsin in terms of the driftless area and all the glacial features of Eskers, Drumlins, and outwash plains and assorted terminal moraines and so forth that are on the landscape. And those landscape features then determine what vegetation is present, and vegetation determines the complement of wildlife species. So the short answer is, sure, our glacial and geological history shaped what we have today in terms of plant communities and therefore shapes the wildlife community. We also have, in part because of the way Wisconsin's structured and our relationship to other parts of the country and ancient glaciation, have what's described as the tension zone that runs from northwest to southeast in an S shape across central Wisconsin. And that essentially marks a coming together of range boundaries of northern species at the southern edge of their range and southern species at the northern edge of their range. So that, which also is related to the physical geography of the state dictates the kind of animals that you expect to see or hear when you're in the North Woods, as opposed to the kinds of animals you expect to see or hear down here in the Driftless area or the agricultural parts of southern and southeastern Wisconsin. So that's kind of an involved question.
Yeah.
But the short answer is, and of course, if you go back far enough, when Wisconsin was under a mile of ice, there was no wildlife whatsoever. And if you go back further to when there were species like mastodons and mammoths and so forth roaming around, that too was all related to our geological history.
Rick in Portage County, thanks for calling. Hello, what's on your mind?
Good morning, guys. Just by pure serendipity, I was in the woods. I live in southeast Portage County, and our home is in the woods. The noise that you played, that gentleman played, I heard almost the identical thing as far as I could tell, except that sounded like a single creature that the gentleman played. Well, this was two of those.
Okay, Rick, we're glad you heard it, but tell us what you think it was.
Well, I went out in the woods with a light, and they separated, and I saw the back end of a coon going away.
Uh-huh.
I'm assuming the other one, moved away and circled around in the woods around our house, just as that guy described. I've been in the woods all my life. I'm 63, and I've never heard that sound before like that.
Well, I thank you very much for calling, and I'd have to say that coons, when in a first of all, they can be pretty good size, so they're big enough to create the so-called crushing of brush and so forth that was heard. And they're quite mobile, so they could circle around the house. So that all fits. And I would just say that when there's a couple of adult coons with a territorial display or a dispute or something related to breeding activity or whatnot, they can make some incredible. If you ever hear a raccoon fight when you're camping, it will raise the hairs on the back of your neck. So that's certainly a possibility.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought. Can I throw in a quick question about Fisher that you mentioned earlier about the purple marten?
Sure.
We have Fisher on our land, and our A Fisher. I've seen him deer hunting, and I see his tracks in the winter. In your opinion, is there can they have a detrimental effect, like on fawn population and game bird populations, when everything is young like it is, you know, now and has been for the last month?
Well, you know, I'm reluctant to pin any blame on fishers. The reality, Rick, is that everything in the woods either eats something else or gets eaten. That's the way the system works. And fisher, as a member of the weasel family, are certainly predators. They're very capable predators, and they have a fantastically diverse diet. One of my colleagues who works with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission has studied fisher diet in the past, and he once, when I was teaching the vertebrate ecology class, I had this pie diagram of what he found as fisher food items. And it was impossible to come up with enough colors in the color palette to color all the little teeny wedges, because virtually everything you could think of, from snakes and amphibians to porcupines and squirrels and fawns and birds and eggs and worms and everything else, was all represented in their diet. So sure, a fisher living in your woods that comes across a nest of grouse chicks or a newly dropped fawn might very well have a pretty good meal, but so will a lot of other things that are also in the woods, and in the bigger scheme of things, probably doesn't make a great deal of difference.
There you go, Rick. Thanks a lot. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven. Thank you for listening in, by the way. Questions for us, give us a call at 800-642-1234. And Daniel in Minong has a chance now. Daniel, hi.
Hello. I think that animal sound recording is a juvenile Sasquatch. west of Minong near McLean Lake, forever the squirrels were gray. And about 4 years ago, I came up here to discover the black phase had appeared, which previously I had seen only near Oconomowoc.
Mm-hmm.
Why would the black color phase have appeared? Any theories?
I don't think it was probably a case of of a sudden appearance. Actually, black squirrels are pretty common across northern Wisconsin and far more common in northern Wisconsin than in southern, in my experience, although there are pockets of them here and there. And once they're present, that persists. It's simply a color variation of an otherwise perfectly normal gray squirrel. So in a litter of gray squirrels, there may be a black one or two along with perfectly normal grays. And then there are other intermediate color phases as well as a golden yellow one with kind of a golden tail that I once heard called a Lady Isabella squirrel, although I can't track down any reference. People have asked about that. It was something my predecessor, Bob Ellerson, who was wildlife specialist for the state for many, many years, told me about that, and I've since seen them, even some here on campus. And then, of course, there's the possibility of albino squirrels, which are white, and we'll get to that in a moment. Mm-hmm. So that there are a number of possibilities, and when I was working in Oneida County on Lake Tomahawk for the university, not only black ones, but seeming variants where you'd have basically a black body and kind of a beautiful auburn-colored tail or vice versa. And over the years, I've had people send in all sorts of variations, but the common one is black versus gray and then sort of a golden or brownish color, a little less common. So.
Then thanks, Daniel, for calling. And if you go to my Facebook page, just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, you'll see a picture listener Sandy took. It's great picture.
That's a nice picture.
Of an albino squirrel that in the Superior.
Yep. Those occur too, obviously. There's one looking at us in the picture, but less common than the normal color variants that you'd see in a litter. But where those tend to occur, if they're in an area where there's some protection afforded, there was a very well-known population of albino squirrels, for example, in a park in a small community in central Illinois in years gone by, and they became a bit of a tourist attraction. But with the particularly with the white ones or the albinos, and to a lesser extent with black ones, they're pretty conspicuous on the landscape. So one assumes that with natural selection, they're more vulnerable to predation and such things and perhaps don't persist to the extent that normal grays do. Anyhow.
Here's another identification with a really cool picture. Is this from Jessica? Is this an osprey nesting on Chippewa River in Jim Falls?
Well, it is an osprey, but it looks like it's sitting on the railing of a bridge. But if the bird is tending a nest nearby, then it certainly could be. But it is an osprey, and they'll nest on platforms that are erected for them. We've got nests here in Madison on transmission towers. And, of course, they'll use tree snags and things like that. So it is an osprey.
And a real nice picture from Michael of some hummingbirds as well on the Facebook page.
Those are very nice, too.
Yeah, very nice. Glendale, Wisconsin.
As a matter of fact, Larry, talked a little bit about this magazine. The article that I used because of my personal aversion to technology was an interesting article on how these various social media things are being used in terms of wildlife education and management. And they talk about Facebook and Pinterest and a whole host of other things and really some fantastic opportunities to share things like this that, you know, and when we started doing the program, somebody had said, gee, I've got to remember the picture of the so-called prairie dog.
Yeah.
And all we could do is say, hey, mail us a picture. And, you know, 4 days later, we get a Polaroid snapshot in an envelope in the mail. But now it's instantaneous and the quality is fantastic. It's pretty cool.
It is very cool. Mo in Glendale, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning. I know this is a common problem throughout most suburbs now, but with the coyotes, I was startled the other afternoon at 3 o'clock to see, when I drove into my driveway, in the lawn next door, a large, beautiful, healthy-looking coyote at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
So I made the noise and chased it and whatnot. It wasn't frightened of me. I have a small dog. I have a 20-pound dog that never is out by himself. But I've been told that they don't attack dogs for food, but for competition for the food source. Is that true? I mean, he never is by himself.
Well, I think the motivation, frankly, isn't important. If the dog gets grabbed, then that's the important element, not whether the coyote was thinking, holy cow, he's getting my lunch, or I'd like his lunch, or I'm going to have him for lunch. That doesn't matter. The fact is that coyotes do occasionally snatch small dogs. 20 pounds is actually pretty good size. Coyotes aren't as big as they look. But if obviously you've got coyotes in the neighborhood and they're bold, or if they're emboldened by someone feeding them, which is even worse, then it pays to have a healthy respect for them and to just make sure that your dog, as you say, is not out on its own and has some supervision, and there shouldn't be any problem.
Yep.
It's a finite risk, but it's a small one, and it's a risk that people in neighborhoods on the edge of town or neighborhoods near green space take, much the same as your pets that are wandering across the street take the risk of car problems. So be careful, and you should be fine.
Thanks, Mo. Thanks for calling. Chad in Spillville, Iowa. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
The last month or so, I've been observing a badger. Not every day. I do the mail, so I'm driving around the country, and there's a big mound with a hole in it. And I've seen him or her, I'm not sure, by that mound. And, you know, he's only, I don't know, 15 feet away in the ditch. And I made a little, kind of like a squirrel noise. And he'd come out, you know, with the big broad shoulders. And I was wondering if that's a male or a female, or if they're breeding or raising little ones, or how many they have. I just don't know that much about a badger. I've bought them through the years trapping and what have you, and I was just kind of curious about some of the ins and outs of a badger.
Well, it's a neat thing to see. They have a high profile in Wisconsin because, of course, of the mascot of UW-Madison, so everyone recognizes the black and white facial pattern. So seeing one and identifying it isn't a problem. They're a big member of the weasel family. They spend a fair bit of time digging and underground in their burrows. They're rather secretive. It's a treat to see one.
Yeah.
If you know where there's a den, in the past we've had some wonderful pictures submitted. I've yet to see a live one in the wild after 40 years of roaming around Wisconsin. They're here. They're statewide. They don't exist at particularly high densities. And because there's not a great deal known about them in Wisconsin in terms of basic facts, there's a really cool badger study going on now in conjunction with UW-Madison and Stevens Point and some other cooperators. And I think if you want to access the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology website on the computer, I think there's a link to our most recent departmental newsletter, and there was a really cool summary story in there of that research project. And I think you'd probably find that interesting. Beyond that, in terms of, you know, more details of what they eat and how they get along during the year, any good field guide to the mammals, or a book like Jackson's Mammals of Wisconsin, or Long's Mammals of Wisconsin, Wild Mammals of Wisconsin, would give you more detail than you probably wanted.
There you go, Chad. Thanks.
But you're lucky to see it and enjoy it while you can.
Absolutely. Phil in Wanakee, hello.
Yes, I have a question. I hear noises in the woods like this other guy does.
Mm-hmm.
Are there such things as tree toads that make a real screeching noise?
Well, there are two species of tree frogs, and they do sing in the woods, and they sing at night, and they can. We've got quite a population of gray tree frogs near our cabin up in Price County. The breeding pond is like right under the bedroom window, and when they get cranked up at night, they are pretty loud. But it's more of a bird-like, very melodic trill. It's rather a pretty sound. I wouldn't necessarily describe it as screeching, although after you've lain there in bed for half an hour listening to them, it becomes more like screeching as time goes by. So, yes, the answer is we do have tree frogs. They do sing, and they can be quite loud. But there are other things, of course, like screech owls and things that really make some noise. So I'm not altogether sure what you're hearing, but it certainly could be a tree frog.
Could be. Thanks for calling, Phil. Appreciate it. Kathleen in Duluth, hello.
Hi, how are you? This is my favorite show of all radio.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, it is. Well, anyhow, I want to know about fawns that are dropped in the, you know, not too long ago, this spring, because the spring was so long. And we've seen several of them. We see them, you know, in the grass, in the tall grass. They'll be setting there. And we haven't seen them since. Does the mother keep them back in the woods for a while? I mean, we haven't seen any spotted fawns at all.
Well, I know that there are a few around my own home. We saw them, but frankly, the vegetation is so thick and dense right now. About all we see going through our prairie now is the head and ears of the doe. And even though the fawn may be there traveling with her, which they'll do after a while, early on, they simply leave the fawn, and the fawn sits there in the vegetation, under a tree, whatever, and relies on its coloration, lack of scent, and so forth to protect it. The doe visits it to nurse it, and then after a period of time, the fawns will start moving with the doe. But frankly, unless we happen to catch them crossing the driveway or literally where I mow the lawn, you would not know a fawn is there, even though it may be.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really a function of the tremendous growth of vegetation we have this year that they're just hard to see.
And a fawn will stay with a mom until almost the next year, right?
Yeah, through the fall and
right,
so on.
Right
so,
through the fall.
Be patient. You may catch a glimpse here and there, but you know, although fawns have been dropped, there are some really interesting, the DNR is doing some really big fawn survival studies around the state now and coming up with some interesting stuff on fawn mortality rates. So the fact that you see a fawn one day doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be there the next day. I'm afraid the one we've been watching was actually taken out in the hay mowing operation yesterday. But anyway.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, will be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we will be back with Scott. Stay with us. We have so many great regular guests. They come by to spend time talking with us and sharing what they know, and there are only a few who have as much a following as Scott Craven, our wildlife ecologist. We hear often from listeners who want to hear Scott explain behaviors, animal behaviors, and give us some tips, and here he is again. Right up until 12:30 today. Thanks, Scott, for coming by.
Oh, it's great. I wouldn't miss it.
I tell you what, we're having a good time. Daniel in Oneida County has a question about some eagles, and you know what? Why don't we just go to Daniel? Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call. I'll be real quick. We live on a peninsula on a lake in Oneida County, and on this point are some very big, tall white pines, in which is nesting a pair of eagles, and they have an immature, a young eagle who is very active, and actually he was on the ground hopping around. It's a mowed area maybe 50 feet away from a house, but was just hopping, walking around, et cetera. The question we have is, does this have an adverse effect on songbirds? Because with the occasional, other than the occasional robin, we don't have any songbirds here, which we normally have in plenty.
Well, eagles are not predators on songbirds. They're just not built that way. It's primarily fish, and they're basically big scavengers in a sense. So there's
That's
really
why you'd see them in the middle of a field, probably.
Yeah, there's no particular risk to the songbirds. However, a young eagle just learning how to fly is a pretty big bird, and if it was hopping around on the grass where I, as a songbird, happen to be looking for a worm or whatnot, I might think twice about being there too. So there may be just a little bit of disturbance factor, but in terms, I'm more inclined to think that the absence of birds you're seeing is related to this general phenomenon that's come up throughout the program. I don't have any hummingbirds, I don't have any orioles, and that's related to the kind of bizarre weather I think we've had.
Yep, there you go. Thanks, Daniel, for calling. Scott, there's some bat regulations we need to pay attention to.
Well, I just wanted to remind folks that I've had a lot of calls and emails the last couple of weeks about bats in homes and bats occupying or not occupying bat houses. And just wanted to remind people that we're currently in the middle of what's basically the cease and desist period. If you have bats in your home, you've missed the spring window of being able to deal with it, and the fall window will start August 15th. But the long and short of it is that the relatively new regulations the DNR put in effect to protect colonial bats, and particularly because of the threats of white nose syndrome and other things that are going on. Anyway, you cannot mess with bats between June 1st and August 15th in terms of attempting to get them out of a house. That's the nursery and rearing of the young period when they're vulnerable. So no bat proofing can occur between June 1 and August 15th, plain and simple.
And, you know, there's a Wisconsin Life piece on bats and pups, those pups that come in early summer. Carrie Rutherford shares the story of one young bat she found in an old stone barn.
The bat in my husband's hand shakes, as if palsied. It clicks, steady as a Geiger counter. I think it must know it's defenseless. I touch its soft brown fur and gray wings that together span barely 3 inches. The clicking intensifies. The light is fading as we stand next to the old stone barn, looking for a bat-sized chink in the wall. The wildlife rehabilitator told us to find refuge for this pint-sized creature, to place him up high, to increase the likelihood that he would drop and take flight. We found him inside the barn at the base of a cinder block wall. Every day, 20 or so juvenile males crawl down from the roost to hang precariously by their toes, pushed out of the nest by their mothers. By night, they are gone, except for those pups that have fallen. There's a recess at about eye level, and I clear talus from the ledge. My husband makes a drawbridge of his palm, and the bat shuffles across, then turns to face us as it backs into its cave. "You did well. Just think good thoughts and check on him in the morning," says the rehabilitator, when we tell her we've released him. "Thank you so much for caring." The next morning, we return to find the bat gone. We have saved a life, or so we hope. I think about the difference one bat's life might make. It's spring out here in the country, and the fecundity is ferocious, nature's indifference to individual fate. Some newborns live while others die. I know this, and yet I remain unable to bear witness to impending death. I return to the barn at dusk each day to find more juvenile bats and to save them. The next bat we rescue is smaller and much weaker, but as it scrambles across into the chink we locate for him, his speed belies his tiny size, and we think good thoughts. When we check on him in the morning, he is gone. I cheer on those bats I have rescued, but my hope begs the question, does what we're doing matter? To borrow from the central image of the butterfly effect and claim that the flapping of one set of wings can cause a storm is equally to admit that we can never say for sure what causes what. Small events can have large, widespread consequences, or they may not. I'm left to feel big and important, or small and insignificant, as I choose. I lean toward seeing myself as a small, unknowing part of life, which is not a terrible thing. I walk the earth, rescuing some bats and missing others, living in the small space between mattering greatly and not mattering at all.
Kind of a nice piece there. Carrie Rothbard is a nonprofit consultant and grant writer, and it was great to hear. A nice little piece.
It's good to know people care about bats. That's changed a lot over the last few decades, and it's a good thing.
Carrie Rothbard. And Wisconsin Life, by the way, produced by Erica Janik, and this episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Dick in Bark River, Michigan, has a story for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dick.
Hello again, thank you. I live in the edge of hayfields and a private wildlife refuge. Anyhow, heard a whippoorwill a couple nights ago, you know, and they're very uncommon, but it brought me back to maybe 35 years ago, and I was sleeping in the front porch of the old farmhouse and couldn't go to sleep because I'm trusting my memory and not to exaggerate, but it whippoorwilled 700 sometimes without taking a pause, a very short pause, and kept up again. Is that true? I really think it is. I was so mad. I was unhappy.
Well, they can. Having a whippoorwill, it's a really cool night sound. Not many people hear it anymore because they have become less common, but they are incredibly persistent, and the 700 quick calls at repetition doesn't surprise me. If you have one on a horizontal limb that they're prone to sit on outside the bedroom window, they make the tree frogs we talked about earlier pale in comparison. So that's a cool story.
Thanks, Nick. Thanks a lot for calling. By the way, I did want to mention, you know, we talked about eagles just a minute ago. Joy Cardine's going to be talking about eagles tomorrow morning, so I just want to make sure of that at 6 o'clock on her program here on Wisconsin Public Radio. So if you're interested in learning more about eagles, Joy's going to be talking about them at 6 tomorrow morning. Scott, we've got a bunch of deadlines here.
Yes, for folks, you know, here it is July already. Summer's going to pass very quickly now, and all of a sudden fall will be upon us. And people who are thinking about the fall activities, fall hunting seasons and so forth, August 1st is a key DNR deadline. And for anyone planning to participate in fall turkey hunting, Canada goose hunting in the Horicon Zone, bobcat, fisher, otter, or wolf seasons, all have to have their permit applications in by midnight August 1st. As simple as that. In the case of the turkey permits, for example, there'll be almost 97,000 of them, same number as last year, and there's certainly a good chance you'll get one if you draw. And then, of course, the leftover permits go on sale on later in August. So you get a second chance with turkeys, but with some of these other things, you don't. So if those activities, fall turkey hunting, Canada goose hunting in the Horicon Zone, bobcat, fisher, otter, or the wolf season, which, of course, is going to enter its second year, you need to get those permit applications in. You can get those from your license agencies on the Internet through the DNR toll-free number. But August 1st is the deadline, and that's not very far away. There will be, by the way, just since I mentioned the wolves, a lot more permits this year. The DNR board approved a higher wolf quota of 275 animals, and for that they'll issue 2,750 permits. So I think that's a bit more than double last year's in terms of numbers of permits, so people need to be thinking about that. And, of course, how that wolf hunt and the harvest quota will play out with regard to tribal use of permits, which was an issue last year, or the use of dogs in the hunt, a lot of that is yet to be resolved, but at least the quota has been set.
All right, there we go. And we had an email from Megan in Waupaca. Two fox dens for about the last 6 years, sandy hills and, you know, under a huge brush pile. On a trail cam, we've seen rabbits nosing around the entrance. We've also seen woodchuck leaving the same hole as the baby foxes. Is this common to have multiple species sharing a den? There are a number of entrances and exits.
Well, there are only so many animals that dig dens. And, you know, your friend and mine, the woodchuck that was mentioned as nosing around there, is one of the primary excavators. And that was, I think, one of the rationales for protecting them back 40 or 50 years ago.
Yeah.
So dens dug by woodchucks or foxes or whatever else are notorious as shelter for a whole host of other animals, from snakes and salamanders to woodchucks and rabbits and a whole host of other things. So they're a beneficial feature, habitat feature on the landscape. My guess is, however, that seeing some of these other animals around is at a time when the foxes may not be using that den that the young have left. It's not in a rabbit's best interest to enter an active fox den. That's a bad move for the rabbit. But nevertheless, the fact that the dens and tunnels and the foxes may have lots of different entrances and mounds and so forth does provide habitat for lots of other stuff.
An email from William, what's the DNR policy on the otter population? Otters are down from 15,000 in 95 to below the DNR stated goal of 13,000. As someone who enjoys seeing them every summer, what's the policy on the otter population now?
I don't know offhand. That's not one I've been tracking, but my guess is that with the stated declines, and this seems to be something they've checked into the details of, otters and the permits for harvesting are tightly regulated, and I'm guessing that any population decline like that would be met with a commensurate reduction in harvest pressure through trapping to attempt to rebuild the population to the stated population goal. I just don't know what actions have been taken to in accord with that.
Amanda in Eau Claire, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Hi there. How are you guys today?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Good. Yeah, I had a question about wolf spiders. Unfortunately, we found one trying to sneak into our house with its egg nest attached to it. Thankfully, my husband saw it, successfully captured and took care of it for me. But our neighbors also had a wolf spider. He was moving some planters around, and it was pretty good, like 2-inch-sized female wolf spider trying to attack him, bring him in, or so we said. With all the extra rainfall, are they just coming out, and now they're more around houses, and is there any way we can protect our houses to keep the wolf spiders out? Because they're kind of nasty little buggers.
Well,
it all depends on your level of arachnophobia, I guess. I'm not particularly fond of them, as some of my friends well know. And especially wolf spiders do get, you know, they kind of have the appearance of a tarantula. And
yeah.
My daughter and her family were just at our cabin last weekend. And when she got there, she described what probably was a wolf spider in the sink, which she described as, oh, my gosh, it's a tarantula. And our 7-year-old grandson had to deal with it. So their shock value is probably more of concern than the actual threat they pose. And for folks fascinated by spiders, they're pretty cool. For folks less enthralled with spiders, they're a lot less than cool. So I just can't tell you much about their current population or behavior. That's another question, like the situation with ants, that is best deferred to Phil Pelletieri next time he's on.
Yeah. Amanda, thank you very much for calling. I guess I wouldn't worry too much about it. I don't think you're going to be invaded by a horde of wolf spiders. I'm pretty sure of that. Someone emailed to wonder why they have never seen a bird eating an ant. Why do birds eat ants? And
some birds eat lots of ants. For example, flickers are notorious for hopping. I mean, there's a member of the woodpecker group, but when they're hopping around on the ground, they apparently are pursuing ants. Ants, of course, have various degrees of formic acid, making them perhaps unpalatable to some a species, but there's some use of ants by birds to take advantage of that formic acid for their own purposes of reducing parasites and whatnot. So it's a it's a complicated relationship, but not all birds will eat them, but some do a lot.
And, you know, we've got, I'm thinking about an event coming up, Scott, that I want to be sure to mention, because you're going to be at it. And a lot of people around Wisconsin will, and they should be looking for you, and that is Farm Technology Days. Let's make sure we mention that.
Well, our whole Extension Wildlife team will be at Farm Tech Days next week. Mm-hmm. Setup is on Monday. The show is Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday,
yep.
And it's up near Rice Lake. I can't be specific as to exactly where, but it's not a hard event to find.
No.
It usually paralyzes traffic for miles around. So it's a big deal in the agricultural community, and Jamie, David, and I will be there for varying lengths of time manning the wildlife booth in the Progress Pavilion. So stop by and say hello, and we'll talk about some of these wildlife issues.
And you always have lots of great things for people to look at in your tent.
Usually. Jamie's tasked with setting up this year, so I assume she'll have the small mammals and turtle shells and a few other odds and ends. But one way or the other, we'll be there. I think David and I get there Wednesday morning sometime, and we'll be there until the show closes. So
there you go. David in Eau Claire, hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, David.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure if that was me or not. I have a problem with a woodpecker that keeps landing on the metal flue on our cabin. It just loves to land there about 5:30 in the morning, and it makes such a noise it resonates through the whole cabin. And I'm wondering what this woodpecker sees in this metal flue that makes it so attractive.
Yeah.
Well, all it sees is a big resonance chamber, actually, and it's a territorial display. I mean, obviously, there are no insects in a piece of metal. Right. There's no nesting potential, but they will hammer on downspouts, TV antennas, things like that, because it makes a racket. And in the spring, it's a territorial display. Woodpeckers don't sing like cardinals and robins and whatnot to attract a mate. The males hammer. And that particular one has figured out this a really good spot to make a racket. So it's unfortunate, and short of, wrapping what it's what it's using with some cloth or a little bit of thin foam or something like that to make it unacceptable, or putting some streamers or pinwheels up there or an owl decoy or something else that might spook it out of the area, it's going to continue that until its interest in the nesting season has waned.
Okay, well, I certainly appreciate your answer.
All right, thanks, David. Appreciate it. And, Scott, we had some more things.
There was just one more, Larry, that I just wanted to touch on, and that's, again, with fall not too far away, to think about. There's a lot of interest in grouse numbers every year, especially in the northern part of the state. And we're kind of in the decline phase of the rough grouse population about 3 years in, and I think all expectations were that we'd see we'd take a big hit this year. And, in fact, statewide, the spring grouse surveys, the drumming counts were down about 9%. But most of that decline was in central Wisconsin. The northern parts of the state, which is a lot of destination for a lot of grouse hunters in the fall, mm-hmm. was actually up 2%. And that seems seems inconsistent with the decline phase, but the result or the rationale for that lies in last year's drought. The grouse broods, the chicks, it was dry, it was warm, they had fantastic survival. So there were lots more birds than normal in the fall, or than expected in the fall population. That's carried over to higher than expected spring drumming counts of last year's young, which are now adults. But the kicker is, even though the counts are up, the speculation is there'll be fewer birds in the population this fall than last fall, primarily because this year was the exact opposite of last year. It was cool and wet, and that's not good for grouse brood survival. So despite the fact that there's a lot of ins and outs in what's happening with the birds, wildlife population dynamics can be complicated, there'll probably be decent numbers of birds in areas where people find a concentration, but the population's likely to be down again as part of this decline phase.
Scott, we had kind of some sad news in a way earlier this week. A guy who was a regular on my radio show for a long, long time passed away. Gordy Cunningham.
Yes, Gordy Cunningham was an extension forester in the department that I'm still affiliated with. And he was the forester when I broke in back in, they hired me in 1979. And mm-hmm. those early years of my career, I spent lots of Saturdays out on private woodlots with Gordy doing woodland owner field days. He was just a great guy, retired quite a while ago. I believe he was 94 when he passed on Monday. And he was well-liked by many, many people he was just a pillar in the Wisconsin conservation community for many years. So it's a big loss.
Yeah, it is a very big loss. And I did want to mention that. And wishes go out to his family, certainly. We have a lot of things we could talk about. But, Scott, here we are. We got the last minute here of the show. Anything you want to leave our listeners with?
Well, let's see. We talked about some of the fall outlooks. The outlook is also bright for waterfowl populations. I just had my copy of the Ducks Unlimited magazine came yesterday, and I looked at the map of North America, and holy cow, most of it's green, dark green and blue, which is good, very good to excellent duck habitat. Yeah. That's to be expected with the rains we've had. And waterfowl populations have been just unprecedented for the last few years. So that's very good news on the wildlife front. Just a reminder, people brought up fawns, baby birds, baby animals.
Leave them alone.
They can generally, unless they're in immediate danger, let the parents take care of them.
Scott, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Look forward to your next visit. And he'll be back. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest, and he will be back. I'll be off a day or two tomorrow. Judith will be visiting with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert for our traditional 4th of July bird watching show. I hope you can tune in, and I hope you will join in. And thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.